Hello, Blenders. On this week's show, it's James Bond week on Real Blend. We are reviewing No Time to Die with Cinema Blend's expert Mike Reyes joining us, and writer-director Cary Joji Fukunaga is this week's guest.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome, to episode number 185 of Real Blend, a podcast with a license to pun. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and on this week's show, it is James Bond week on Real Blend. We're going to have reviews of No Time to Die with a very special guest. Cinema Blend's Bond expert, Mike Reyes, is going to be joining us later in the show as we talk No Time to Die. And the guest is Cary Fukunaga, the director of No Time to Die. He joined us for a exclusive interview regarding all things Bond and his first chapter and Daniel Craig's final chapter. So we're going to have a lot to dive into. And by we, I mean Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jake. How are you?
I'm doing well, my friend. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, thank you. Not dressed nearly as spiffy as Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. I love that color on you, Kev. That looks great. Color.
Thank you. License to pun is so perfect. And I know we'll get into this later in the show when we talk about the movie.
Yeah.
But there are some incredible James Bond puns.
There are some good ones.
I honestly think Real Blend listeners, because we do so many puns on the show, it's going to connect a little bit. Those puns were pretty out there.
I blew the joke because Gabe wrote that joke. It was a good
great
one.
Joke.
And I was supposed to say Blend. Real Blend.
Okay.
That's pretty good.
Still glad you said it, though.
Thanks.
It is good.
Did. Yeah, got a laugh. If you're watching us on YouTube to see Kevin's handsome outfit, hello. Thank you for joining us here on the visual aspect of the podcast. Make sure you hit subscribe and turn on your notifications. We've had a lot of people who are joining us lately due to interviews with Mike Flanagan and Andy Serkis. So we appreciate you guys growing that YouTube page. If you are listening to us where you get your podcast needs met, thank you very much, of course. Have you signed up for Real Blend Premium? This is a ad-free version of the show that you get through the premium membership. You also get an extra segment every Monday where we play some type of fun game and a newsletter. Oh, I'm going to write a newsletter this week. So go to cinemablend.com/realblendpremium to sign up for that. And also, I want to let you guys know that there's a bonus episode of the show this week. We had an interview, standalone interview, with Julia Ducournau, who her film Titan won the Palme d'Or. Not the Tom d'Or. this year, and it's an interesting film, and this is a fascinating conversation. I didn't get to do it. Jake and Kevin did the interview this time, and so I got to listen to it as a fan. And Kev, you're right, listening to her talk about the Wonder made me want to instantly go back and rewatch it. Because
what about the
way
you didn't get to the no scene, did you? The way she explains how she does, there's a scene where a woman breaks her own nose against a porcelain sink.
Yes.
And I would like you to at least see that scene and then listen to her talk about it.
Yeah.
To go between the two.
Really, rather
the
not. Li-
The literal thought process. What's interesting is like it's the thought process that she went through. That interview is really cool. Jake and I did it. Definitely check it out on our feeds. It was a bonus episode, and yeah, that movie is pretty wicked. So
we have a couple of other interesting interviews coming together, starting with Cary Fukunaga. That's going to be on the show in a bit. So let's get to the weekly poll, because this is James Bond focused, and Kevin, I'm going to throw this one to you. The question was, what has been your favorite era of James Bond films? I want your answer first, Kev. Okay. What's been your favorite era of James Bond films?
Well, I have no problem saying this. Daniel Craig is my favorite Bond. And I've been saying that in my interviews. I mean it. He's just, for me, it's, and that's one of the questions I was asking in my Junket interviews was, like, one day these movies, like his Craig films, will be classic films, like you go back and you watch Connery and Roger Moore, you're watching the older classic Bonds, like, and it's interesting to think that one day these five will also be like
all
a classic
five,
set of
all five of them.
Well, I'm talking classic in the sense of like just like it's an older Bond. I mean, Quantum of Solace definitely not, but No Time to Die has some amazing moments. I love Daniel Craig, so that's my favorite era. Even though I don't like Quantum of Solace as much, I've gotten a little more respect for Spectre after revisiting it. No Time to Die has enough greatness in it that it's worth seeing. And then obviously Skyfall and Casino Royale are just out of this world. So that's my favorite era.
All right. So for the choices in the poll, we gave people Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Daniel Craig, and then other. So other would be your Timothy Daltons, your Pierce Brosnans.
Yeah. I'm surprised Pierce wasn't an option. Which it's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, but because I feel like so many people that listen to our show are of the age that Pierce was likely their introduction into Bond.
Yeah. Oh, no, I agree 100%. But who would I have replaced? Would I replace Roger Moore?
Roger Moore.
Pierce Brosnan? Because you only get three.
Right. And then
choices.
Do other. Yeah, I would say.
You would replace Roger Moore?
I'm not saying that Roger Moore is better than Pierce. I'm just saying that for a lot of people, at least the first Bond movie I ever saw was GoldenEye. So though I'm not like outside of GoldenEye, I'm not a massive fan of the Pierce Brosnan movies. He has a soft spot in my heart because he was my introduction to the character.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry.
Give me the three again that you're on the list.
Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Daniel Craig, and then other. So where do you think the people went?
Well, I mean, Connery just passed. And I feel like, and I'm not saying that's why they would have chosen him, but he's been on our minds a lot recently. He did just pass. He's arguably most people's favorite Bond. I mean, every time I ask somebody that, when I tell someone Daniel Craig's my favorite Bond, they're like, they think I'm crazy. I'm like, no, I just absolutely think Skyfall is a masterpiece and it's the best Bond. But I'm going to go Connery just because I just feel like that's the general consensus.
Well, Daniel Craig won the poll. And
that's honestly what I would have thought.
I like that.
And he got 007%. No, I'm only kidding. He got 68% of the vote. 68.
I'm curious as to how you, because I know we're going to have Mike Reyes on the show, who is an encyclopedia of all things James Bond. But I really think a lot of people out there haven't seen as many of the old Bonds as we think they have.
That's
right.
Fair.
Right.
That's fair.
Well, and these, it's also worth noting, these polls take place on YouTube and Twitter. So, it's a segment of a segment.
Sure.
People that use those platforms.
It doesn't feel like there is as much of a pressure to fill Daniel Craig's shoes as the next Bond as there has been on other people who it was like, I couldn't imagine trying to follow up Connery. Roger Moore kind of aged out of the part, but when Timothy Dalton got it, I think people were really excited for him to get it. And same with Brosnan. Like, people have been saying for years that Brosnan should have gotten it, and then when he finally did get it, it was like, oh, great. I think that's why GoldenEye plays so well. But then he ended up getting shafted on his other movies. His other movies are just not good.
Oh, we not going to talk about George?
George Lazenby? I guess so. We'll let Mike talk about that one, because I know Mike loves the one film that he was in.
What is interesting, though, is GoldenEye is Brosnan's only great Bond, but I think GoldenEye is one of the best Bonds of all time.
Oh, 100%.
It's good. It's interesting. Brosnan's films will be looked at as classic Bond films at one point as well. Like GoldenEye is GoldenEye now like in that grouping of like you go back. Well, I guess not. We're too close to it. Maybe like 20 years.
They're
from
all
now.
Reflective of an era. They're all like mirrors to society at that moment, particularly like pre and post Cold War.
really, I think, shifts Bond. And that's, again, that's, these are all things that Mike can weigh in on.
Personally, I think the Connery era is iconic, and that set the stage. But I think that the love for those is more a reverence for the era and sort of the nostalgia of it.
Yeah.
And not that they're fantastic films that still hold up.
Right. But they're classic in a sense of
they're
what
they
did.
They're classic in a sense. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think definitively of all the Bonds, Craig's era of films, even the bad ones, are a step above the rest in kind of the filmmaking quality, the sort of the intensity of the plot, and even how the character, like a lot of the other Bonds are sort of reduced to gimmicks and stuff, which is fun. They're very fun. Sure. Like the Brosnan stuff is fun. But
you know what's interesting? Craig movies, I think, are the first ones that went out of their way to hire better directors.
Yes.
With all due respect to the other directors.
One of the Craig directors was a past Bond director.
So Martin Campbell did GoldenEye and Casino Royale, which is cool.
But I think Casino Royale and the Craig era came about when Hollywood films in particular were all moving towards the gritty realism, Dark Knight.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
Everything was kind of moving in that direction, and that was a natural thing for them to try with James Bond, and it works. It really works.
One man who has helped shape the direction of Bond for at least one film.
You were about to introduce Mike.
No.
I was like, wow, that's excessive.
Not at all. Mike does not get to go before Cary Fukunaga. Cary Fukunaga directed a Bond film and was nice enough to join the Real Blend podcast to talk about No Time to Die. So stop listening to us and listen to Cary Fukunaga talk about No Time to Die here in the Real Blend podcast. I think that the second most important thing for a Bond movie, beyond who's playing Bond, is who is going to direct the film. And so when you're a filmmaker who ends up in contention to potentially direct a Bond movie, I'm just super curious what those conversations are like. What are they looking for you as a filmmaker? What do you say to them to almost pitch yourself to say that, like, yes, I'm sort of worthy of this mantle? And what is that like?
Thankfully, I didn't have to pitch myself. I think I'd be really bad at having to say, like, here's why you should hire me. Thankfully the conversations with Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson were conversations. We sat down in Barbara's home and she told me, you know, what they'd been working on, and she showed me some outlines and what they hoped to accomplish with this film and some ideas for characters and a potential ending. And then I just sort of spitballed literally with them and didn't really have to say, like, you know, here's why I'm the right guy for the job, because I've always struggled with that, even since like college, having to write, like, you know, statements of purpose.
You know, Cary, this is one of the few films in cinema history that's shot with 65 millimeter IMAX cameras, which is incredible. I mean, you got films like, obviously, Nolan's movies with Dunkirk and Interstellar and Dark Knight. Obviously, Brad Bird used it for Ghost Protocol. Linus, your DP, used it on First Man. That 1.43 is a very special thing to see. Like, and there's nothing more massive or immersive than seeing that on the biggest screen. So I wanted to ask you, what was your first and or favorite experience you had in like a 70 millimeter IMAX 1.43 movie, and what did it mean to you to actually be able to shoot on that format?
Oh, man, I mean, I obviously saw lots of documentaries. I remember going to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and seeing, you know, that 10:1 scale movie about the universe with Morgan Freeman narrating it. But then in terms of the cinema, I'm wondering if it was Batman. Was it Dark Knight, or was it... was the one with Heath Ledger called?
Dark Knight.
Yeah, it was Dark Knight. I think that with that bank heist scene in the beginning, I think that was the first time I was conscious of, like, the IMAX, you know, opening up in the frame. and obviously I was sold as a viewer. I think that's one of the best openings to a film ever, that bank heist. You know, having worked with it now, having seen our screen tests and looking at the negative and the projection and seeing what it looked like, it's just like, I would love to shoot on that format. You know, we went to, Linus and I went to IMAX in the fall, before Linus came out, for pre-production, fall of 2018. And we went to look at a bunch of comparison of films that they had done on IMAX. We saw ones that were shot digitally. We saw ones that were shot on 5 perf, and then also on 15 perf, and different versions of projection, laser and standard. And as soon as you saw, like, the film projections of the IMAX, it's just it's incomparable, and it's one of those things that you can only really realize, especially for people who aren't used to the difference in person. You know, you have a lot of people that watch their TV with the settings set to sports, and they have no idea why their movies look like telenovelas all of a sudden.
Well, I can't wait to see the 1-4-3. I know you haven't seen it that way yet either, which is crazy. I can't wait.
No. I just can't believe we have a podcast where we have a Bond director on talking about how awesome Batman is. Like, this blows my mind that this even exists. Kara, you know, you and I spoke yesterday about, you know, you had those certain beats and those certain traditions that you really have no choice. You have to include in a Bond film, you know, the Bond, James Bond, and Martini shaking out stirred. And I'm curious, of all the traditions that you knew you had to put in, which one was the hardest to wrap your brain around in terms of how you can make it your own? Because you don't want to just throw it in there. You know it's going to be a moment. But which one did you have the hardest time sort of making unique so that it was special to this film?
Maybe the opening, you know, because I think there's so much expectation on the opening of a Bond film, and there's so much expectation on the ingenuity of, like, whatever the stunt work or the extreme sports motivation for the action is in the beginning. And it was just like, I remember kind of hitting a wall with it and realizing, like, why are we trying to, like, top it by, why are we going at this from backwards? You know, why is it about the stunt? Why isn't it more just about what's driving the story here? You know, and I'd kind of forgot myself for a second, like, wait, the whole point of the action is that it's supporting the narrative. So once the cold opening became the story that Madeline told Inspector, and the introduction of the villain was brought in there, then the opening really became about, how do we show the audience that this is tying up what happened to Casino Royale with Vesper and Mr. White and Madeline, and now villain that's attached to Madeline, and how all is this going to come to head, and how Blofeld and Spectre has also tied into it, and then make it something that's surprising. And in some ways, you know, thinking we know where this is heading, and then obviously deeper in the film, once again, undermining that expectation. So it really all just became about, you know, an escape. You know, for an escape from an impossible situation, and then let it be that, and not try too hard to be something unique or different just to be unique or different. Just make the tension and the drama be the driving force. I think my favorite part of the opening really is that scene where the car is just being shot up in that hail of bullets, and the camera is just really patiently in the car with them, and we're not doing anything crazy. We're just experiencing the danger.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Kara, you come into a franchise here where Daniel's now, this is on his fifth one. I mean, no disrespect to you, but arguably I think he knows the character better than you do, probably. What's the hardest part about giving direction? So what's the most difficult part about giving direction to an actor who by this point probably knows more about it? If you see something that you would like to go after, or if something isn't working, what's that like?
Well, if I see something that's not that I'm noticing, I mean, my job there is to just look for details, look for things that are going to pull a viewer out of the moment, looking for a way to make sure that there's a seamless move from shot to shot to shot that just feels like you're being propelled through a story. I think... there's probably a misconception that directors feel the need to impose their will on every moment. And a lot of times, you know, when you're dealing with great actors, it's once the script's done and you've discussed what's happening, there's actually much more of a release of what's happening. And if anything, you might guide or adjust, but you're not there to like stomp on the performance. You're just there to observe and make sure everyone's in the same film.
You know, Kara, I love the horror element almost of the opening of the movie. But when we get to that scene that you just mentioned with the car and the bullets are pummeling the windows, and then obviously we have the spinning shot with the guns, I just want to geek out with you about that scene because it was one of the first scenes I saw. It feels so practical and it feels so immersive. And I just want to know what was actually happening on the day. Were you really firing at the windows? What were the actors experiencing? And then when it was spinning, were the bullets really like kind of coming out of the car? Like, how much of that is practical?
Almost all of it's practical. So the smoke's practical. Yes. The casings are practical. You know, Chris Corbell came up with this whole system that the miniguns, you know, the I forget what caliber we ended up using for the minigun, but, you know, those cases are just coming right out the air vents on the side of the DB5.
Cool.
That's, you know, we set up a camera just so that we can get that, you know, that those things flying out.
That's awesome.
and then for the windows being shot, same thing. We have these rigs that essentially shoot pellets at the glass, And it's a very slow process, right? So you get a take, it's going to take 30 minutes to replace the glass and do it again. So you have to make sure you get it right. And the actors, you know, Leia and Daniel have to play it right. And it's a lot of pressure because there's a lot of, there's often a tendency in movies now to say like, we're just going to do that as VFX and we'll do 17 takes and move on. And no, we had to do it in one or two takes because we just didn't have the time.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that was a fun one to do. And obviously the DB5 is a beautiful but very compact car, so very difficult to get, you know, the 65 mil cameras inside of it, but we managed.
So that scene is one of the ones that goes to the 143?
Yeah, definitely.
I can't wait to see it. I'm going to there's a theater near me that plays an IMAX later. I'm going for that scene alone.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few times we use 5 perf in that scene simply because I wanted to get the dialogue of the day and not have to ADR it. And we do that, I think, in Norway too. But most of it was shot on the 4:3 cameras, you know, and it's like we just dealt with the sound. I mean, those things literally, they sound like coffee grinders as they're going.
Yeah. God. Wow. That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Carrie, I want to talk about James Bond, Daniel Craig, running down the alley, his last shot as James Bond ever. To what degree, you were talking about being a director and you're observing. To what degree were you being a director of that moment? And to what degree were you just a fan getting the chance to watch movie history? And how difficult was it to say cut the last time?
I mean, I would definitely say I was just much more of a fan of that moment because it's not a technically or even dramatically demanding scene. It's David Denzik being dragged, you know, from a barbershop down an alleyway by Bond. And I think we did like 2 or 3 takes simply because I couldn't say check the gate and be done with it all. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know what I was looking for. There was nothing additional that I needed out of that moment. We could have called it after one. That just didn't seem right.
By the 84th time, Daniel's like, why are we still doing this?
I think everyone was happy to keep it going because like, we knew as soon as we said cut and check the gate, you know, the old fashioned looking for hairs in the gate. And,
check the gate.
That would be it. That would be it for not just the movie and all that, but 15 years of someone's career.
Wow.
Carrie, this film has so many spoilers and surprises, and this has nothing to do with the specifics of them, but the longer that the film got delayed, you know, it's one of those movies that just kept getting pushed back to wait for theatrical. Did you fear that somehow, some way, you know, its secrets were going to get out? And how do you feel when a movie is being told it's getting released in one area a week ahead of, say, another area?
Like, yeah.
What is it like protecting the secrets of the film?
I think there was like some potential leaks over that year and a half, and I think people just kind of ignored them. I mean, Eon and Barbara Michael are very good at basically ignoring anything they don't want to address, you know, in terms of like Daily Mail and things like that. So, you know, I think no one really kind of gave any credence to the stuff that was being said out there. And we had to be really careful about who was seen in different places and what actors and stuff like that. So it was, you know, paparazzi had shot stuff with Leia and I, you know, on the waterfront in Italy when we're shooting the final sequence of the film. And you can see cast members there. And so, you know, luckily it didn't really gain any traction. And of course we were, you know, worried about what could come out because not just because you want things to be a secret for secret's sake, but you want people to enjoy a film and all its surprises without any expectations. I mean, it's why I love to go see movies without really knowing sometimes even what they're about. I'd rather just be surprised. And there's so many people that want to kind of spoil it for the people, and that's unfortunate. But I think
I was interested. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I just think we got pretty lucky, though. And so far, people have been respectful. And, you know, at least on my Instagram, every time people put spoilers on, I just erase it because it's like, I don't want people to spoil it for the people.
Yeah, very true.
Okay, I'm interested in knowing when the title sequence is done in terms of, like, what you do as a director in terms of the title sequence, when that is shot. Is it a day where, like, everyone comes in and does a certain thing for that shot? I was watching that great documentary, and you saw him, like, spinning in that one crazy room. So I was wondering, in terms of your direction for the title sequence, how it directs with the song, because I love Eilish's song so much, and I wanted to know where your
Well, one, just in terms of the selection of the song, I obviously loved Billy, and really that was the I was in the lobbying corner for her from the very beginning. But the quality and feel of the song, to me, I thought it would be great if it really meshed with what's happening in the story at that moment. Sometimes a song doesn't feel like it has anything to do with what we've just seen or where we're going. It's a cool song, yeah. But it's like it becomes like its own little mini chapter. And I really thought it'd be great that everything felt seamless from start to finish in the story. And therefore, if we could go out of that moment, you know, of the end of that opening and into the song and feel like we're just continuing forward through the experience, so much the better. And then in terms of the execution of it, the way it worked is Danny Kleinman, who's done, you know, many of the opening sequences, came with Barbara, and we just started looking at images and concepts and themes to play throughout. And he kind of had an understanding what the movie was about, but hadn't really, you know, seen anything yet because we're still shooting. But he knew, like, for example, that there was a version at one time where we were going to push the DB5 in the water at the end of that sequence. And in the end, we didn't end up shooting that, but that becomes a part of the credit sequence. What I wanted to do was I wanted to go back to an analog feel to the opening. I wanted it to feel like the old kind of like 1970s and 60s versions of the opening credits, like You Only Live Twice, Dr. No with the dots. And You Only Live Twice, it's, you know, like the umbrellas and the kind of the circular motifs and the kind of duotone backgrounds mixed with the kind of CG creations he was doing. So it had this kind of like album cover mixed with contemporary CG vibe to it. With also, I asked him to put in the sort of like gate drift. So rather, and he laughed because he's like, you know, I spent all through the 80s trying to make sure the image didn't float in the frame, and now you're asking me to make the image float in the frame.
He's like, I can't win.
Can't win. Yeah, we finally got to perfection, and now no one wants perfection. So, wow. Yeah.
No, but it was awesome.
Carrie, Kevin mentioned that the documentary, which I think all of us loved, it was really, really enlightening in a lot of ways. One of the things I did not realize was that Daniel Craig did most of Spectre with a broken leg. It was just kind of astounding just because how much he is determined to do these stunts himself. As a director, knowing the challenges that came before, what is the balance of like, yeah, it'd be great to have my actor actually do these stunts and it looks fantastic versus like, this could be like a serious problem for us and has been in the past?
I mean, especially Daniel got injured in the first 2 weeks of shooting on this thing. Yeah. So,
yeah, I remember.
And I remember the day because I mean, Lee Morrison's an amazing stunt coordinator. So it was an unfortunate, you know, event that he slipped on this like ramp because it had grip tape and the shoes had grip as well. It just whatever it was, it just didn't land right, and you know, which meant that any stunt we had going forward, I felt like a extra like. You know, helicopter mother on scenes, just trying to make sure that like there's no place that Daniel can get injured because Daniel's in 98% of the movie, so it's like we can't lose him, you know. Yeah. And so you know, he would do obviously his punch up stuff and things like that, but it's like anything where he could potentially be injured, you don't risk your actor. I mean, it's amazing, you know, the actors who do their own stunts and how that becomes kind of a sales point for the story. But I think the most important thing is that you know. When someone's watching it, they just don't know.
Carrie, I know you've done so much press, and we really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us. Can't wait for everybody to start seeing this, and continued success. Thanks so much for joining the Riverblend Podcast.
All right, thank you guys.
We want to thank United Artists for giving us time with Carrie Fukunaga. So excited for everybody to finally get a chance to see Bond, especially here in the States. I know if we have some international listeners, there's a chance you probably got a chance to check it out already. We're definitely not going to get into spoilers as we continue to talk about the film because there's a lot of big reveals in this, and we want people to listen to this podcast beforehand and experience the movie as it's meant to be. Kevin, I know you had something you want to throw in?
Yeah, and one of the things that you'll notice when we get to the review aspect of it is how much focus I'm going to talk about in terms of filmmaking, in terms of what they did, in terms of just the quality of the actual filmmaking, Lena Sandgren's cinematography and all those kind of things. But one of the things we didn't get to bring up in the interview, which I did bring it up in my TV interview, I know Jake and I are geeking out about it as well, is his Warner and True Detective, because I think it's episode 4, I believe, of the series. It's a 6-minute Warner. It's one of the greatest wonders I've ever seen achieved. It's brilliant. And I know we didn't get to talk about it in the interview, but I do want to mention that that's the reason why I was excited for this Bond film. Because with, I mean, obviously, aside from Craig, like, Carrie's work on that shot. I mean, Carrie's a DP. I think Carrie also shot, I think he shot Beast as well. I think he shot that movie and directed it. I think he was the DP on that as well. So now he's bringing in Lena Sandgren, who's, you know, Chazelle's dude, who did, like, First Man, La La Land. So I just wanted to just highlight that shot. And if you haven't seen True Detective, Jake and I talk about it all the time. It's an immersive wonder. And he said in my interview, basically, like, the thing he learned from that shot was that he wanted to become more spontaneous on the Bond films. And there was so much planning that went into that wonder that he feels like it takes a little spontaneity out of like trying new things on set. So he actually learned a lesson of, like, not doing something like
which
that
which I feel
again.
Like we hear a lot, like Flanagan said after Hill House that he would never do it. It's, I feel like everyone's experience doing those massive wonders is often to never do it again.
Yeah, and we love them. And then Flanagan obviously has talked about those wonders a lot, and obviously the whatever, there's 4 18-minute wonders in episode 6 of Haunting of Hill House. He has a great 7.5-minute wonder, which he goes, oh, it's only 7.5 minutes in Midnight Mass on the beach. But yeah, they're really hard to pull off, and filmmakers learn a lot about themselves through them. But I just want people to seek that shot out if you haven't seen it.
Wait, no. Hold on. I'm going to bring up something, too, because I find this interesting. Maybe we shouldn't bring up the wonders quite as much anymore. From this perspective, when I watched True Detective, I didn't know that it was in there. And there's nothing quite as exciting when you get to a wonder and you're about 2 or 3 minutes into it, and then you're like... Okay. Wait a second, they haven't cut away yet. Because I was really late to True Detective. I was like a couple of years behind it. I didn't have HBO at the time that it was big. And so when I finally got to watch it and that scene started playing out, you know how exciting it can be.
Yeah, but I mean, but like, what are we?
It.
We're just not going
to
talk about things because
that's our show. We're a filmmaking show.
I know. No, I understand. Like,
we could not talk about Empire Strike, the twist in Empire Strikes Back, because someday someone might see it and has, you know, like,
see,
like what is the statute of limitations?
Trying to say.
No,
you
I
know
do,
my
but
points.
I also think that they're at a certain point. Like, I'm glad that you were able to experience it at 3 years after. But at a certain point, we got to be able to talk to stuff. And if you're behind, you're behind. And that's the risk of...
Dude,
that's pop culture, man.
Fair.
If Spielberg opens West Side Story with a one-hour wonder, we're not going to ask him that question?
He opens with a wonder. So is the title card hit after 1 hour? It's 1 hour hits, and he's like...
There is a movie, an interesting film called Russian Ark. I think it's 99 minutes. It's literally one shot.
Yes.
And what was that? There was a horror film that came out a few years ago. Wasn't Elizabeth Olsen in it?
Yes, but was it Silent Hill?
Silent Hill's a video game.
Russian Ark was stitched.
Silent
too,
Hill. Oh, I'm sure it was stitched.
Russian Ark is not stitched. It's literally a 99-minute take. They did it 4 times. Everything is in one shot. No stitches.
Water. I got to point out, too, if you want to go find Julia's YouTube interview with us, because when Kevin mentions, he just off the cuff goes, I don't know if you have a stitch in there. And she's like, oh, no.
Oh, no.
Like,
she's
there's not a stitch.
She's offended.
How dare you think
she's
I have
a
stitch?
She's a little bit surprised that you even knew to, like, reference the stitch. But then she was offended of, like.
I don't know. No. I think you guys read that wrong. I edited this, so I looked at this very carefully. I don't think she was offended. I think her reaction was, oh, there wasn't a stitch. And it was really hard to not put a stitch in there. Like, it looked like she was
fair.
Oh, yeah, no, it was a tough one.
I agree.
Like, we went full bore.
Yeah. And then she walks through that process. I mean, for people who listen to the interview, they had to change the camera rig mid-shot. I mean, I don't understand how they pulled that off, but it's an incredible wonder. Dude, we are a show that talks about filmmaking. Wonders will be here forever. I'm sorry.
I know.
They will.
No. I'm just saying, let's remember that the audience experience is still something I like to preserve for people who haven't seen it yet. So.
You're listening to the wrong podcast.
I'm hosting the wrong podcast. All right, this week
Sean's
in movies.
Sean's going to create a new podcast called Can't Talk About It.
It's just me sitting here.
No wonders.
Is that where we get to talk about things that are embargoed vaguely?
Yes.
Can't talk about it?
There's something coming out called South of Heaven. Is it a streaming movie? I don't know anything about this. Gabe, you knew about this one?
It's a limited release. It looks... It's Jason Sudeikis, and it's like a thriller kind of revenge-ish kind of movie-looking thing. It is utterly distracting that he does the Ted Lasso accent. And as someone who has seen Ted Lasso season one three times through and loves every second of Ted Lasso content that we've gotten, it just kind of feels like Ted Lasso is in a movie.
Like, see, that sounds
like
me
not Jason Sudeikis doing Ted Lasso in a movie. It sounds like Ted Lasso got cast in a movie. So he's really trying to be this like that's serious. Yeah. So from that perspective, it's interesting. But it didn't look very good to me. That's just the trailer, though. The trailers are not.
Okay.
But I found it was distracting for me because he does the Ted Lasso accent. And it feels like, maybe reading too much into the marketing, that they know that and they're kind of just like putting it out and getting rid of it kind of
I just want to make sure that Ted Lasso still believes in South of Heaven. That's all I want to know.
Sure.
So wait, is South of Heaven like hell or South of Heaven like where we are, like the world?
I haven't seen the movie, so I can't tell you.
That's very deep, though.
There might be a town in deep. Louisiana called Heaven.
I thought hell. I thought hell when I heard that.
Okay.
It's definitely it's an angry looking movie.
I wonder
if
Road to Perdition leads to South of Heaven.
That's interesting.
I'm sorry, that's not good enough for fucking Real Blend.
I just gave you a lie. I said that was good. Go back and watch the video. I gave you a good reaction.
Gabe, stay right there, because I'm going to mention briefly that on Disney Plus there is something called Muppets Haunted Mansion. None of us have been able to see it yet, but we know that everyone appreciates good Muppets content. So go out of your way to check out Muppets Haunted Mansion. Dirk Libby, who is a Disney aficionado, specifically the parks, and likes Muppets a lot too, wrote on Cinema Blend that it is a really good Muppets project, but he also said it's great for people who like the theme parks because it references the Haunted Mansion ride and might be one of the closest things to, although now with Scarlett Johansson settling her lawsuit, we're going to get a Tower of Terror movie she's going to be in.
Is she going to be involved in it?
I think she is, yeah.
They kissed and made up that much?
I think they did.
That was all lawyer speak, and like they needed to set a legal precedent. I don't think there was anything. I don't think she was calling anybody and being personally offended by it. I think it was just very much she had a contract was breached and they had to figure it out.
And she had every right to that money. And I think I read this on Twitter today. I could be wrong. Isn't Black Widow now streaming on Disney Plus like genuinely?
Today. I think today.
Yes.
Wednesday.
So for anybody listening to our show, which is coming out Friday, you can now watch Black Widow basically with your subscription. Yeah.
I'm gonna go watch it again.
I might throw it on later on.
That's exciting.
Except for the third act. Yeah.
Stop. It's good. Gabe, you saw Lamb, the A24 film.
Yes. What an interesting week. I've seen everything you guys haven't.
That's fine. What about it? Is it good?
I saw it a couple weeks ago, and I have spent, not every day, but I've spent a lot of the last couple weeks trying to figure out how to describe this film. It is a really interesting film, but I think in the end, having thought about it quite a bit, it's more simple than it maybe on the surface seems to be. It is about anyone who wants to just see it. You know, like I'm going to talk about what's in the trailer, so I won't spoil anything. But the trailer does give like a lot. Like I went into it without seeing it, the trailer, and it was interesting to see what happens. But the premise, which I will pitch, dip now if you plan on seeing it and don't want to know, is this couple in Iceland who live on a farm, take care of a farm. They're kind of secluded. A lamb is born on their farm, and it is half lamb, half human.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. It is as strange as it sounds. And the drama of the movie from that sort of thing is them, this couple sort of getting an attachment to this. And it's sort of this metaphor for like family and love and motherhood and fatherhood and all these things. But it's also not like a great metaphor for all these things.
I'm going to need you to elaborate a little bit more on the half lamb, half human.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it literally is the person's torso up and then the lamb's body backwards?
So the head and the right arm are lamb. Everything else is baby human.
I gotta be honest, I'm in. I'm sold. Yeah.
Yes.
So it's not poorly made. It is really well made. There are some effects that are like, oof, that's a little, that one missed. You know, there are some shots that they're digitally filled in and it doesn't look great. A lot of it does look really good. Noomi Rapace is fantastic in it. She's really fantastic in it. And I haven't seen her in anything since Bright, actually. She's been in stuff, but I just haven't come across her work. And so it was a great reminder of how amazing Noomi Rapace is, because she's great in it. It's interesting. I think it is worth seeing if you hear A24 has a horror movie starring Noomi Rapace and you, the premise of that, then yes, it's worth seeing. If that sounds weird to you and you're not interested in it, it doesn't do anything that's like, no, you have to go see it. The larger problem for me is the second act is kind of disjointed from the rest of it. It starts and it's a really interesting start. I mean, a baby is born and it's half lamb, half human. Okay, where are we going to go? Then the middle happens and it's about that. Another character gets introduced and this sort of family life thing goes back and forth. But then by the time we get to the third act and by the time it ends, it's hard to say that the middle really did much to inform the ending. It kind of feels like they had a beginning and an end, and then they put this kind of interesting family drama in the middle of it. And it's okay. I think it's okay. It's the director's debut. I think his name is Valdemir Johansson. And it's the sort of film, it's the sort of debut that you go, okay, I'm interested to see what he does next. Like, it does enough good, it does enough interesting, but it doesn't do enough to where the metaphors of it feel very fleshed out. It's Bergman-esque in that it's kind of surreal, but also it's hard to understand. And at first, I left thinking like, okay, maybe I just don't get it. Maybe this is based on some sort of, you know, Icelandic mythology or something that I'm not seeing that it's pulling from. Maybe it is. I couldn't find anything on that. But I think the answer is it's more simple than maybe if you leave there kind of feeling empty, which I did. I think it might be because it's kind of more simple than you might expect it to be. It's not. It's definitely pulling from the Witch and Hereditary vibe. Yeah. Okay. And that era of horror.
Yeah.
It does not do it as well. It doesn't do it as effectively, but it also kind of feels like it's doing something different. It is funny. Like, you laugh at the premise and like it is, there are moments of it that are funny and I feel like we're supposed to be funny. And that's part of the strangeness of it, is that it dips between those tones. So I think the filmmaker is interesting. It has enough good to it that, like I said, I'm interested to see what they do next more than anything, but it wasn't, it certainly was no Hereditary or Witch.
Which is what I think of when I think of A24 horror.
Yeah, it's different. It's different. Jake, I think you will. I don't think you'll love it. Sure. Maybe you will.
I'm intrigued enough to want to see it. I'll rent it one night.
I 100% think it's interesting enough for your taste.
Yeah.
And anyone who kind of feels himself aligned with Jake, it is an interesting enough movie to watch. But if you feel like you're on the fence about it, I wouldn't say it's, you know, you need to see it.
Sure. Does it explain why they're silent?
I've been twiddling a Silence of the Lambs joke in my mind for the past 5 minutes. It just wasn't ready. It wasn't ready yet.
Neither was mine, but I tried it.
Yeah. No, it was great.
A part of maybe this, a little bit of the disappointment is, again, I went in pretty cold because I saw, A24 and farm animal based horror film. I'll probably enjoy this. And so when it opened, Jake, it was giving very, 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 very stiff John Carpenter's The Thing vibes. I was like, oh. And I had, like, in my head as the opening is going on, I was like, is this going to be like The Thing in Iceland? Are these lambs going to, like, they're all secluded out here? It's not that. It was quickly not that. And so maybe I was a little disappointed in that. And now someone needs to make that movie. But yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting.
Right. Interesting. Not quite as interesting as director Fran Kranz, who, as Kevin will point out to you, played the stoner character from Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
And I don't really know him from much else other than that. That's the character I know him for.
He got pulled over in Training Day.
Training Day.
For doing drugs. They're in a Beetle, right? Aren't they in a VW Beetle?
Yeah. Yeah, he pulls him over.
Which came out 20 years ago yesterday.
Yes, it did. Yeah, very interesting. So he has a film out now called Mass, and he wrote and directed this film. First time director. And it is decidedly not anything that you would expect from the stoner from Cabin in the Woods. It is it's a drama that's primarily set in one room between four characters after it gets through a setup where you are introduced to the situation that sets these four characters up. And it's arguably four of the best performances I think that we'll see for the rest of this year. And it's Reed Birney and Ann Dowd. The two of them play a couple. And then it's Jason Isaacs and Martha Plimpton. Now, you guys tell me, Can we talk about the reason that they're together?
No. And I really want to, I was hoping we wouldn't, because so to me, this film is brilliant because it's all told naturally to a point where like exposition really isn't used. So for me, all you need to know going in is it's two couples who are meeting after some type of tragedy. That's really all you need to know.
That's fine.
But the to me, the film is best experienced with the release of the information in the room as it happens.
I agree.
And I really hope that that's my experience with it. I think that's how the they would probably tell you to watch it. It is. That's the whole thing. That's the whole. And you're watching the movie. You're like, what happened? What is going on here? Why? You know, and to me, that's the unraveling of it. Yep. But Fran Kranz, who is this is funny. The other day I was in hospitality for, I think I told you guys this, for Mass. And, you know, they were setting us up for the interviews. We were getting ready to go in the room. And I'm talking to one of the production people from the production company who's running the press junket. And I guess he had his headphones out, and I'm like, dude, I can't believe the pothead from Cabin in the Woods directed this movie. It's like, because it is so different. And all of a sudden I hear in the background, Cabin in the Woods, and Fran happened to be in the room, and he heard my so he comes over to like the camera, and he's like, dude, I was like, dude, I love Cabin in the Woods. He goes, I hope you introduce me like that in the interview when we talk. He was so good. Cool. But he's genuinely like, so Cabin in the Woods is, you know, it's a whole nother thing. It's a masterpiece. But this is, it's very shocking this comes from him, but also here, it also kind of shows you one thing. Like, I looked at him as that character from Cabin in the Woods, right? That was my memory.
But that's a performance, though.
It's a performance, right? But it's still shocking that that person wrote this and directed this.
I mean, that's like, you know, someone being like, oh, I can't believe the guy from Philadelphia was the dude from Bosom Buddies.
True. Similar. But one of the things that I find interesting about this film, and one of the things I talked to Fran about in the interview, is Sidney Lumet and 12 Angry Men. I'm reading that book right now called Making Movies, where Sidney Lumet's talking about lenses and narrative and basically how the lens changes in the room in 12 Angry Men get more claustrophobic. So you start feeling tighter and tighter as you're in that room. Franz did the same thing. He was talking about these really cool lenses that he was using as the room. He gives you the space in the beginning. You understand the room, but as the tension gets more and more, you're zoomed in. You're like, it is. These narrative choices of lens work plus performance is really, it's outstanding. It's an outstanding film. Like, I mean, like, it is, it's very hard to watch. It's like this moral ping pong in your mind as you go back and forth, as you understand what's going on with these two families. And it gives a perspective on something that I hadn't ever thought about in terms of that. I think you guys know what I'm referring to, but the other side of that.
Yeah, I would
and you know what I mean? Totally. And the family. So that's all I'll say. I think it's best to go in cold. I just found it to be heartbreaking, but also weirdly, the movie kind of helps these people in a weird way.
And so, us and the audience. Absolutely.
Yes, that's what I'll say.
Jake, you think we're going to get an Oscar nomination out of this cast?
I think Ann Dowd and Martha Plimpton are really solid. I'll be very curious to see. What do you think they're all going to push for supporting? How do you think they're going to do this?
That is interesting. No, I bet you that they're going to determine that some of them are lead and some are supporting.
How? They probably all have like almost like number for number.
I know. No, it's going to be category fraud to a certain extent, because you're right. They are all four equal parts.
Yeah.
But why would they want to compete against each other?
I mean, I don't think they have a choice. I'm sure they don't want to, but like they, at the end of the day, that's, I mean, but like even something like Trial of Chicago 7, they just all went for supporting.
Right. And then
didn't Alicia Vikander win for The Danish Girl in lead?
Supporting.
Oh, she won in supporting.
Yeah, she won supporting.
Which one?
I'm fairly certain. I'm 90% sure on that.
Okay.
But I agree with Kevin. And this is honestly actually one of my favorite movies so far this year. And I've been an Ann Dowd fan for a while, so I would really love. She did a film
a while back. If you haven't seen it, it's a true story. I believe it's called Compliance.
Oh yeah, and it is one of the most, fast food restaurant.
Yes, and it's one of the most uncomfortable films I've ever seen in my life. But Ann Dowd is incredible.
She is.
And deserved an Oscar nomination for that. Everything that Kevin said is absolutely spot on. You know, it's interesting. I brought up the idea of to the cast whenever, because we all spoke with them on the same day, about how much I would love to see this on stage.
Mm. Yeah.
And and Reed liked the idea, but Jason very heatedly shot that idea down.
It's
and
too
was
much.
Like, no, because no, for him, he said no, because what the thing that works about this movie is not just what the conversation is about or how they're delivering it, but that we get to see them like right here, like the camera's right there. He goes, what you get out of this film, you're not going to get if you're in, you know, row 12 of the terrace seeing this on Broadway.
That's
interesting. You're just not going to get the same, it's not going to be the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
And, he goes, and that the quieter moments are given more intimacy.
And he knows theater. I mean, he's done theater.
Yeah, exactly.
So he must
I took his word for it. But it's an incredible film. And whenever I tell people, you know, and this is such an oversimplification, so please forgive me for this. But like, whenever I tell people, it's basically four people in a room talking.
Mm-hmm.
Some people go, "Ooh, that's interesting," and some people go, "Oh, no." And I go, like, "No," because once you sit down and go, "Oh, that's what they're talking about."
Yeah,
you can't turn away. You just can't.
And the release when the dialogue comes in naturally about what it is, it's just so well written. It's so well executed.
It is. I can't wait to see what he does next.
And they did a really, really good job of just emotionally helping you understand. I mean, I've never seen anything like that. It was pretty wild.
There was a film that did something similar, and I think it was based on a play, I believe a few years ago, called Carnage with Christoph Waltz.
And Kate Winslet.
Yes.
That was very similar. Wasn't it like a bullying situation?
Yes, and I believe that was based on a play, but for some reason, that one relied a little bit too much on let's watch these people just rip into each other, and isn't it so fun watching? And this one is not about that, and it's not to say there aren't heated moments, there absolutely are. But this one is just feels different. It feels more authentic in my mind.
I'll tell you a little, maybe why. Because Carnage, and sometimes this happens with other films, they feel like they were a play first.
That's right? Interesting, yeah.
So the dialogue is almost delivered that way. And maybe because Mass wasn't. Like, the thing about Mass that I found to be most impressive was how it literally felt like they filmed for 90 minutes straight.
Yes.
Yeah. And then turned to the director and was like, did you get it?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I kind of asked him in the junket. I was like, when did you guys know, like, on the day where you could stop? Because it didn't look like there's any stopping points in the conversation.
Yeah.
And Kev, one of the things they pointed out to me was that they filmed in that room and they were reliant on natural light because it's real windows. It's not a set. So they could only shoot during the day. And once it started to become nighttime, they had to stop. And then the next day, build their emotions back up to where they were the day before and continue. Oh,
that's unbelievable. I asked them about the difference in how they approached the days that were more quiet and intimate and the days that were more heated.
Yeah.
And they said, we're going to be honest with you, there are some days where they were the same day. Where a morning we filmed this part of the conversation, and that just...
Wow.
It's unbelievable. It really is a testament to their acting. I feel bad that Jason and Reed, from what I have read and the impression I'm getting, that they're not quite getting the buzz that Martha and... Jason is an incredible...
Oh.
They all do. Reed, his character is a little bit more distracted and kind of like... I feel like Reed is unfortunately doesn't quite get... But he also has a moment that hammers home. There's a moment where he knows statistics.
Yes.
Of the moment that in that one, like every person gets a moment. It's just, I'm so glad that you guys loved it as much as I did. That really, it could be top 10 for me.
It's a powerful piece of cinema. And there are moments like I'm getting the hair on my arms is standing up.
Yeah, just talking about it.
There's like a moment. There's moments with Ann Dowd and Martha that are just we can't get into if we're not talking about plot, but it is so, it's two parents, right? You know, it's a mother and a father, and something has happened, and they're still parents. And it's such an interesting, I've never seen anything like it.
The trailer
And I hadn't really seen the trailer much, but I will say the trailer might give away a little bit more than you want.
I mean, if you're
curious to see it, just go see it. We're telling you it's great. We're basically giving you the premise. All the trailer is going to do is tell you more than you should know going in.
Try not to know what the tragedy is.
I didn't see the trailer until after I saw it. Luckily, but I'm glad that was the case.
All right. Well, the big movie this week, that's coming to theaters is, not Venom anymore, unfortunately. It's Venom. Probably going to knock Venom out of that top spot. It is instead the return of 007, Daniel Craig's James Bond in No Time to Die. And so because of that, we wanted to introduce a special guest on this week's episode, Mike Reyes, who is a senior movie contributor for Cinema Blend. But more importantly, on the website, he has taken over the James Bond beat, has carved out his niche as the expert of all things James Bond. And so, Mike, we wanted to bring you by for a No Time to Die review, and then you're going to stick around to play the blend game with us. So welcome to the show, Mike Reyes.
Oh, I am so thankful to be back after my cameo. It's brilliant, really.
Good to see you, Mike. We love you, buddy.
So
Kevin, Jake, Sean, yes.
My man.
Kevin and Jake get to see Mike in the junket rooms quite often and interact with him in the hospitality suite. They were telling me that right before you got to go into Daniel Craig, knowing how monumental that was, that the people in the hospitality suite were very excited for you. So that was cool to hear.
Yeah, a room full of very jaded, mean people just felt nothing. And guys, tell me I'm lying. That morning, before we even all logged in that morning, I think we were all collectively more excited for Mike than we were for ourselves. We were texting that morning. Yeah. Oh, this is so exciting for Mike. It was authentic.
Yeah.
There is something very cool when you love a particular franchise or maybe an actor of some such, and then you get the opportunity to speak with them maybe for the first time or speak with them again. So we'll get into Mike's conversation with Daniel Craig a little bit later. Or in fact, if you want to watch his entire interview, it's on Cinema Blend's YouTube channel. And he's also going to be bringing No Time to Die content to the site, of course. But we're going to get into reviews and we're going to talk about No Time to Die. We are going to keep it spoiler free because there are some big surprises in this film. We encourage everybody to try to go out and see it as early as possible. If you feel comfortable going to the theaters and you want to see it opening weekend, so you can be part of the conversation, please do so. Mike, you are our guest. I would like to bring you on and ask you, what did you think of Daniel Craig's final performance as 007?
Well, since we're going spoiler-free, I won't mention the fact that we saw Q's cats, finally. But I think you couldn't have asked for a better ending to Daniel Craig's tenure as James Bond. Casino Royale was... it was the brick through the plate glass window that everybody kind of needed after 40. At that point, it was around the 40-year mark of James Bond. Die Another Day was an experience that everybody definitely had thoughts on. Mm. And it went pretty quickly from, you know, the shocking announcement that Pierce Brosnan is no longer in the role to, oh, Daniel Craig. We've never heard of that. We really haven't heard of this
James
guy before.
Blonde. They called him James Blonde.
James Blonde and then Bland. James Bland.
James
and
Bland.
That's a perfect side note to just say, go watch Being James Bond if you haven't already. Yeah. Some of us were required to do so because of the... That was one of the things they threw in the last minute interview caveats.
Yeah, homework.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful 45-minute documentary. But anyway...
It is great, by the way. It's
yeah,
a good doc.
You should just watch it. It's really good.
Yeah. It's on Apple TV. Yeah.
Is it only about Craig or is it about all
Bonds? Yeah, it's just about Craig.
Just about Craig.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Someone didn't watch it.
And he openly admits that Quantum of Solace is bad. It's great. I mean, which I thought was really satisfying to me because that movie is terrible. But sorry, continue.
They do. We'll save that for later. Okay. Review of No Time to Die. I remember sitting there watching the gun barrel unfold, and it's the first. My first thought was, "Wow! After all this time, it is happening."
Mm.
Cary Joji Fukunaga's work on this film and Phoebe Waller-Bridge's work are felt throughout, and their voices are so unique that you could probably pick out which pieces they threw in. And then, of course, you've got. I'm hoping I'm not screwing up their names. Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who have been on Bond scripts since Tomorrow Never Dies. That collaboration turned in a film that not only plays to traditional strength very well, it also does a lot of stuff that we don't see in the Bond franchise that often. And, you know, Léa Seydoux's Madeleine Swann returns and is probably the person that has gotten the closest to James Bond. And that's the core of the things that happen in this movie.
Emotionally, you mean?
Emotionally, but also yeah. I do feel, I've heard other people say this and I kind of agree, No Time to Die is more of a James Bond movie focused on James Bond. Because typically we get different villains. And the common knowledge has always sort of been, Bond never changes, but the villains change, and that's what we come into. How does he deal with the villain? He deals with a lot of himself in this, as well as Safin, played by Rami Malek, who I think is a very understated and chilling presence in the film. But I think he almost takes kind of a backseat to Bond working things out.
Yeah, that makes sense, because in a way, they were allowed to, with this overarching, you know, five film narrative, explore elements of Bond and his past, and connect it to Madeline's past, connect it to Safin's past, connect it through Mr. White and all these other characters that were like carryovers that in a way had some Spectre underneath it. You know, once they realized how responsible Spectre was for all of this. And I think that that's part of the strength of the Daniel Craig run, is that sometimes these random things that would happen in a one-off James Bond film, and you would kind of just dismiss it as, oh, okay, well, that's the point of this plot going forward. I thought No Time to Die had a really difficult task in front of it to tie up a lot of strings that were there from Skyfall, from Spectre, going back to Casino, because they bring up Vesper and they talk about her role in his life, basically. And none of that would hit if you didn't care about the progress that the character had been going through over the course of No Time to Die. So I think that's a big part of the reason why I was super impressed by it, because it goes to, I think, some really emotional places that the Bond films, like Mike is suggesting, haven't gone to before. And that stuff doesn't resonate if you don't care about James Bond, who is supposed to be, by design, a character who's really cold and aloof, and a little bit too cool for the room sort of thing. So you're not supposed to. I don't know if I've ever emotionally attached to James Bond as a character beyond thinking that he's like cool, right? Like, is that is that accurate?
No, it happened to me in Skyfall, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, even reason? In Casino Royale.
Yeah, Casino Royale, but Skyfall. I always say the first time I ever cried in a Nolan film was Interstellar. And so the first time I ever really felt genuinely deep emotion and like tears for Bond was Skyfall.
Okay.
I don't know why I made that jump, but it was just like, and I mean that by like Nolan had movies previously that he did that didn't make me cry, but then, and so did Bond. And then that one just finally broke the ice for me in terms of, no pun intended. It broke the ice for me to kind of be let into him and in his heart emotionally. That movie changed everything for me.
Jakey, where are you at with No Time to Die?
It is a fairly mixed bag. There are a lot of things about it that I absolutely adore. Probably within the first 20 to 30 minutes, there was a moment where I paused and went like, this could be an all-timer. Like between the cold open that includes a scene that feels like it's out of Halloween versus just, you know, and then also you got this amazing action sequence that we've seen in the trailer a lot. I think my issue with the film comes down to the fact that the foundation of it requires you to buy into his relationship with Madeline, which I didn't with Spectre, and I don't particularly with this film. Bond and Vesper, I am sold. I am in. Yeah. I believe he loved her, and I believed his heart was broken and continues to be broken. Like that, I buy. I don't buy Bond and Madeline. And I really think that if that relationship doesn't work for you, a lot of the things aren't going to hit you in the way that in which they're intended to hit, which I trust me, I wish it worked for me. I really do. So that's a problem for me. I think it works at its best when it's a Bond movie and does Bond movie things. I think it works at its worst when it's trying to impress us by tying it all together. And look, isn't this the big epic finale conclusion? And whenever it's tied back to Spectre and all, you know, but you know, for everything, you know, it's a weird thing, you know, it sucks too, because it was super fun to do a review for a movie that you love, 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 love. And sometimes it's fun to like just rip into a movie that you hate.
it's not very fun to just sort of go like, ah, like
that's the
there's something. Yeah, there are some things I like. There's some things I didn't like. Sometimes those are the absolute worst reviews, and that's unfortunately kind of where I fall on this one. It's middle. It's third for me in terms of Craig's Bonds. Some things I liked about it. Some things I didn't. I loved a lot of the technical aspects of it. I actually think it might be Craig's best performance as Bond.
Oh, unquestionable.
And but I also, you know, so it's I'm sorry, it's not a very sexy review on my part, but that's, I'm just sort of kind of right in the middle on it.
Kev, you were there. Yeah. Are you still there?
Yeah. Well, my point in terms of reviewing this film is, so I gave it a 3.5 out of 5. That's my rating. I did a review on TV that Sean, you saw. I gave a Real Blend shout out there.
Oh yeah.
That's
awesome.
That's basically my thoughts. So I could sit here right now and rattle off so many things about this film that I love. It's technically incredible from a filmmaking standpoint. Cinematography is absolutely beautiful. Shot with 65mm IMAX cameras. Zimmer's score is incredible. Lashana Lynch is amazing. Ana de Armas is amazing. Craig is amazing. Rami Malek, his performance is great. I just didn't love his character. Mm-hmm. But my biggest issue with the film, it's interesting because to me, there's more in this film that I like than I dislike, but the things I dislike keep it from going to the level of Skyfall or Casino Royale. Skyfall and Casino Royale, I think, are two of the greatest Bond movies ever made. This is third, but it's still a good Bond movie. It's better than Spectre, and it's way better than Quantum of Solace. So, like Jake said, it's always hard when you're in this middle ground with a review, because my 3.5 is, I still think the film is good. It's
why
just
did you
not,
hate it? You hated the film? Why did you hate
it? Right.
That's the
why
internet.
Why do you hate this film? Right, that's the internet. So,
but
so
don't
like
review the reaction. Don't jump ahead.
No, but it's a fascinating thing. The culture we live in now is everything has to be the best thing ever or the worst thing ever. This is just a good Bond film. And I say, you know, in terms of from production value, it's the opening 20 to 30 minutes is the best opening in any Craig Bond film. That spinning car action sequence, which was practically done, is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen. I also love Billie Eilish's song. The credits were cool. I didn't think they were the best Bond opening credits of all time, but the song is great.
Song's great.
Staying in the positive lane, it's the blend of John Barry's music with John Barry, right? I got that right. John Barry, Zimmer, Eilish's themes. And then when you're in the middle of an action scene, this film is firing on all cylinders. Like, the action in this film to me is what worked. So when someone asks me, is it worth seeing? I'm like, hell yeah, because like there is some incredible action in this film. My biggest issue with the film, like Jake said, is it was more invested in Vesper than I am in Leia's seduced character, Madeline. So some of those emotional beats don't hit me as hard. So that becomes a little bit of a numbing element. And then on top of that, Rami Malek, as much as I love his performance, he's great in the film. I just don't think the villain was as memorable as like a Javier or a Mads Mikkelsen, just in terms of like what they did. But that being said, the Ana de Armas scene, the opening scene, Lashana Lynch's performance, the action sequences, the almost like video game GoldenEye-esque type thing that happened, like what they do with like the way they play around with just the way the cinematography works. There's so much to like. And like, that's why, Sean, when you watch my review, it's like I can go through all this stuff that I love. And there's there's things I just didn't love. So it's interesting because I asked the whole cast, basically, like, one day these films will be, as I mentioned in the beginning of the episode, these will be classic Bond films. Classic, I mean, when I say classic, I mean, like, they're going to be, like, the older Bonds. You're going to be watching a Bond movie with Craig like you're watching Connery now. It's like, oh, that's an older classic Bond. But I will say, because of what this film does in terms of pushing conversations forward, I think there are things in this film that have changed the Bond franchise for the better. And I think that because of the nature of what happens in this movie, it inherently has to be a classic Bond. It does a lot of things for the first time ever in a Bond movie.
Which
we can't talk about. So that's why I still use the word classic, because to me, like, it's worth seeing in a theater. It's too long, unfortunately. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes or so. I wish they would have cut it down a little bit. The plot's is way too convoluted. So it's interesting, like Jake said, it's a hard movie to review because I liked it. I think it's a good Bond film, but it's not Skyfall, it's not Casino Royale.
I will say that I love that Mike loves it. That makes me very happy.
Oh, well, I haven't got a chance to go yet also.
You want to talk too?
I would like to weigh in very briefly. I fucking love this movie. It's outstanding.
Fuck yeah.
It's good.
No, you had your chance, Mr. Good.
It's good.
It's fantastic. I'm with Mike in the fact that it is everything that I wanted the closure of Daniel Craig's run to be. I put it on, I think Casino is his best. I think Skyfall's right behind it by a sliver. I mean, honestly, they're neck and neck. They're there. And then I think No Time to Die is just behind them with then Quantum and Spectre's a little bit better than I remembered. I said this, and it's random to say, it's like a weird statement about it, but to me it's the first real 007 movie that Daniel Craig got to be part of. Mike, isn't that a running theme in Daniel Craig's movies that like he's always been he's either discharged or M is essentially like suspending him from duty. It feels like he's constantly being kicked out of the organization and never actually able to be a specific spy. And even in this one, he's not even a 00. He's like recruited by the CIA to complete the mission. I'm like, he's never been Bond. You know, he never gets to be like 007 traditionally. That's kind of a running joke with him.
Well, in the classic run, there have been a handful of times that he quits, you know, he quits at the end of Honor Majesty's Secret Service to go have a life. He quits for Revenge and License to Kill. There is definitely sort of a running thread. Every now and then he drops the job and just goes out there for revenge. But I think one of the defining characteristics of Craig's era is Bond is constantly quitting or going rogue. Mm-hmm. Like he's ready to resign for Vesper at the end of Casino Royale. He's technically on a rogue mission in Quantum of Solace to the point where he runs against the CIA.
Yeah.
Skyfall, he dies and then fails all of his examinations like, I'm just going to drink with scorpions and have fun. And oh, wait, yes. Now it's getting serious. I got to come back.
Yeah.
And even at the end of Spectre, he's been on the job and it's like, okay, he starts out rogue and then drives off happily, and that's almost where it ended.
Yeah. That's true. That's right. They almost didn't get him back for that, for the next one. I wonder where I would love to know where the Danny Boyle plot was going to go.
I need that.
Me too.
I wanted
to know that too.
That would have been fantastic.
But I did ask Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson about it.
Okay.
And they didn't go too much, they didn't really go into detail, but they said that he's a great filmmaker. I think they basically just admitted it was creative differences and... Sure. I mean, this is just all secondhand. I'm still sifting through all of this, like accepting that it happened. Yeah. And they're basically like, you know, nothing ever really goes terribly unused in the series. And they kept Mark Tillisley, the production designer from the Boyle incarnation. And even in interviews, he said, I'm still revving Barbara up to get Danny back because I think he'd be amazing with this.
I think he would be great too.
You said No Time to Die was like the closest you'd seen to like a Bond movie.
Yes.
So like what, I wanted you to just expand on that just a little bit because I found that interesting.
Because Daniel Craig never really got an opportunity to, he had some gadgets, but not to the extent that he has in this, like even the car with the smoke and the bullets coming out of the, like Daniel Craig never relied on that stuff in his previous movies up until that point. There's a gag with a watch, and a pun that follows that to me that's very of the formula of Love James that. Bond. And I don't think Craig got the ability to fully live in that type of Bond movie until this one, because I think prior to, they were always sending him down this path of him personally trying to figure out who he is. And that's an interesting story. I think that's a compelling arc to put him on. And no one had done that with Bond before. And so I liked that they did it. But when he got to this one, like there's a lair, you know, for the villain to be in. And that's cool. That's a cool Bond thing. And so I just think he got to do a couple of things that you don't normally get. And they were staples of the Bond franchise. And in a way, the Craig ones got rid of all those. And I think when they did, it was time to get rid of all those. You know, they were overdoing it in the Brosnan ones. But it was good that Craig got a chance to do that a bit. So I was really happy to see him pull off a lot of those. And the puns, Kev, you mentioned the puns. Like, Bond is puns. He's supposed to be.
The puns are another reason why, another positive to add to the review, because they're, yeah, the puns are wonderful and they're punderful. They're so good.
I'm at a 4.5 out of 5. My full review is on Cinema Blend. So go over there and check it out, because we're going to get over to the blend game. And I'm going to let Mike go first. So this is James Bond blend. We are talking about our absolute favorite James Bond films. And I think Mike has probably seen all of the Bond films more than any of us have combined. So this is going to be a really special pick. You know, having a visitor, we allow you to go first. So kick us off, Mike, with your choice for your absolute favorite James Bond movie.
I gave it a lot of thought, and it is definitely hard, because every Bond, I can pick my favorite from every Bond. But Honor Majesty's Secret Service is a film that is near and dear to my heart personally, but also as a film. You got to go back to when this came out. This is 1969. Sean Connery's gone. No one knows who George Lazenby is. He's an Australian model who's brought in to play his first acting role. This is basically the equivalent of, oh, you know, Robert Downey Jr. just, oh, no, even better. Chris Evans just does Captain America. We're going to bring in, if no one knew Anthony Mackie, and they brought him in.
Yeah.
That's right. What this is. This is post-Endgame. Like, you only live twice. Bond supposedly beats Blofeld. And, you know, that's Sean Connery's like, I'm peacing out. The expectations and the reaction to that film break my heart, because it was probably at the time the most divisive James Bond movie.
Can you imagine?
I think No Time to Die is going to be the next one, because it's just at this point where history built the Bond franchise into what it was. And even in 69, it was a juggernaut. So some of the shots in that film are so beautiful that Kevin, have you seen Under Majesty's Secret Service?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, definitely. I've seen the major ones. There are a few that I haven't seen. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I've seen all 25 Bonds, but I've seen the big ones, yes.
The helicopter shot when Bond and Draco are storming Piz Gloria, and it's that beautiful sunset or sunrise. Yeah. I forget if it was sunrise or sunset. There's just gorgeous images in this film that even today it's like, wow. And George Lazenby and Diana Riggs' chemistry is amazing. Telly Savalas plays a fantastic Blofeld that isn't the type that gets lampooned by Mike Myers 30 years down the line.
Yeah.
Like, he's more charming than a Blofeld should be. And again, John Barry hits on all cylinders. He brings that beautiful theme in. The Louis Armstrong song, We Have All the Time in the World, was just the first Bond film that I knew of that had two themes. It had its own love theme.
And that's interesting.
Just hearing that come back in this film, it pleased me to know that Cary Joji Fukunaga and everyone basically appreciated that film enough to reference it now. And he even mentioned, when I spoke to him, he's like, we watched a lot of them for, I triple watched them for, you know, research, and that one just really landed with him. So,
Its fingerprints are all over.
That's no so fascinating. I gotta be honest, I would have lost a bet in terms of what I would have expected you to pick.
And it's the only one that in the classic run, there is a loose continuity, because you go through all five Connery movies, jump to Honor, Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah.
Diamonds Are Forever is a complete insult because it forgets the film even exists and throws in a Moneypenny gag about an engagement ring. But then, after Honor Majesty's Secret Service, you go to For Your Eyes Only, License to Kill, and then, to a certain extent, Tomorrow Never Dies, which is an underrated Pierce Brosnan film, You Heathens. Because that touches on the theme of him being afraid to get close to someone, with him and Terry Hatcher being a broken couple. And, But
what was the one with Denise Richards?
The World Is Not Enough?
Yeah, that's not a good one.
It's Not Die Another Day.
That's my
And I
one.
Still like World Is Not Enough because the things they do with Sophie Marceau's character are very crucial to where they would eventually go.
Wow.
Right, plus, that was the first time we really saw Bond and M get close as like mother-son. Yeah. Like, the old M was always at arm's length and said, like, oh, well, here's your mission, 007. You go and, oh, I'm going to get mad that you've done something that I told you not to do.
Of course.
Whereas,
like, I don't know as much, clearly do not know nearly as much about the Bond sort of just franchise from the beginning. You know, my knowledge of it is fairly loose in terms of I can guarantee you I have not even seen every single Bond movie. I can guarantee you that. Is there a really solid book out there that kind of is you know, the all encapsulating history of that, you know, that's not okay, that's not 500 pages? Is there like a really solid Bond book you would recommend?
Or you should write one.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, well, I kind of want to write a book about the Daniel Craig era.
You should. You should.
That whole thing. But
God, I can't handle more real blend people writing books.
Yeah,
Jesus
don't
Christ,
give away your ideas. That's free gold. Don't do that. One of these two will snatch it up and run with it.
Writing a book about...
There you go. Note to self.
Send tweet.
Hey, there's already a book that... I know of a couple books that were reference points both when I was growing up and also reference points that are out there now. There's one book called Some Kind of Hero, The Remarkable Story of the James Bond Films by Matthew Field and A.J. Chowdhury. I want to say, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. And Mr. Chowdhury, if I'm pronouncing this incorrectly, I'm sorry.
He's a loyal listener.
But that is one that they've updated frequently. That includes the Daniel Craig era. And I think they might do another update after this.
Love it.
And then there's like a Doreen Kingsley book that I remember reading as a kid. And there's several Greg Williams photography books that are amazing. I have the Spectre and Quantum of Solace ones back here. Even Mark Eidlitz put out this really good one, The Lost Adventures of James Bond, where he talks about what could have been Dalton's third and fourth movies, along with all this other lost media that has been, you know, has not been recovered.
That's cool. That's right. Cool. But seriously, no joke, you actually really should write a book.
Jakey, go with your pick. Where are you at?
My pick, I think, is Kevin's pick too. Sorry, Kevin, I don't want to preemptively reveal yours, but...
Well, yeah.
Okay, here's what I'm saying. Mine is Skyfall. And I know it's sort of like...
Well, is it Kevin's as well? Because you guys can just double up.
I'm not sure.
I'm just going to simply say it's Skyfall, because I want Sean and Jake to get more time on that. But yes, Skyfall is my favorite Bond movie. It's a masterpiece. It's the best Bond movie I've seen. And it's part of the reason why I think these films will be classics. These will be a classic era, obviously, of Bond with having that. But Jake...
Yeah, but for me, it's just a matter of I think it's a technical marvel. I mean, there's nothing I can say about Roger Deakins' cinematography that hasn't already been said. I think it is the... Of what I've seen from the Bond franchise, I think it is the most beautiful of the films. I also love the simplicity of it. As complicated as something like Spectre or even No Time to Die, and even to a lesser degree, even Casino Royale can get, I love how simple Skyfall is. Like, Skyfall is an agent who was wronged and wants revenge on M, and it kind of turns into this really cool Bond doing Home Alone final act, which I absolutely love. It really gave us this like backstory in Bond that I never knew I always wanted. Like, I was really intrigued by that, this idea of who James Bond was as a child. You know, there's a degree of darkness to it. It's I know this expression is so overused these days to describe any film that has to do with darkness, but it really is, especially in terms of the Craig era, it's kind of like the Empire Strikes Back of the Craig era, you know, and which is catnip for me. Any film within a series that is referred to as the Empire Strikes Back, whether it's Infinity War or Skyfall, I'm like, yep, that's probably the one I'm going to like the most. I love the darkness to it. I love the coldness to it. I love the brutality, but also like a real heart to it. You know, I still get emotional when Judi Dench passes. And it's an incredible performance. And also, I think Javier Bardem deserved an Oscar nomination as Silva. Like, I love Javier Bardem, and I know this again isn't overused, but like, he to me, he just disappears into that part, and it's so sinister, and he just kind of slinks like a cat. But I all like he's elegant, but also you just know that in a moment he could just like snap and turn around and kill someone.
His introduction speech is one of the best scenes
about the rats. It's phenomenal. But like, it's the so elegance and how he delivers that speech, but then also 10 minutes later when he turns around and shoots the woman. It's just that swing to me is terrifying. I think he is one of the most terrifying Bond villains who I buy from an intellectual, because sometimes a Bond villain, you look at him and you go, oh, like, they're very smart and they got a whole plan, but like, they ain't kicking Bond's ass. Bond's gonna kick their ass. And on the flip side of that, sometimes a Bond villain, you know, like a Dave Bautista, is mostly like used for the muscle.
Yeah.
Silva is right there in the middle.
They have henchmen.
Yes, exactly. Henchmen, yes.
They have henchmen.
I feel like Silva is both brilliant and can come up with these plans, but also like can physically go toe to toe with James Bond, which to me makes him just a, like, chef's kiss quintessential. Everything about Skyfall I love.
I haven't seen Skyfall in its entirety in a long time. Do they ever fight? Do he and Silva fight in the end of the movie?
There's a pursuit. He eventually gets him. He gets the drop on him, but there isn't really a hand-to-hand fight.
That's a missed opportunity. I would like to have seen that.
Yeah, but at the same time, I did like how they pulled that whole last act off and just putting more importance on M too. Like, that was, she was the Bond woman in that movie.
I will add one thing in that documentary, the Being James Bond documentary. There's a great moment of Sam Mendes behind the camera filming Judi Dench's death scene.
Oh.
And it's like a really special moment because he starts crying during it. And it's like, that's the moment where, like, you're watching a Bond fan, like, see M die. It's right. Like a really, and like, that to me, it was like, it just gave me a lot more respect for Mendes as a filmmaker. I mean, I already loved him as a director, but like, that dude cares, man. Like, that was really cool to see that. I mean, Skyfall, I mean, that the blue silhouette fight scene alone, that's all I have to say.
That was also one of two times that Barbara Broccoli really got emotional with the whole process.
Yeah.
It's M's death.
I love that line. There's a line in the documentary that Mike was talking about where the studio wanted them to cut out the line where Craig, you know, where Silva rubs the inside of Bond's leg and says something about the first time, and then Craig responds with, "What makes you think this is my first time?" Which is a great line. And apparently the studio wanted them to cut that out, and apparently Barbara Broccoli was like, "No, leave that in." And of course, it's now this great line because it, you know, just adds so many layers to the character.
Yeah.
She and her half-brother, Michael G. Wilson, are one of the best teams to run a franchise, to hold court over a franchise, and they have an iron grip on this to the point where I'm really wondering how Amazon is going to... I wonder if they even really thought about that when they bought MGM, because it's like, yeah, we could do Pink Panther, we could do Rocky, but what about Bond? Oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're not allowed to do anything with that?
Dialogue, casting, even product placement, it's like all... them, and they stood fast when it came to streamers offering basically, I heard the high end of $800 million, which is basically, if they hadn't delayed that long, that probably would have been okay. We're close to Spectre, we just need to make a little more. But I mean, it's putting up good numbers right now. Pre-sales are apparently pre-sales outpaced Venom and F9.
Oh, after I give my pick, Kev, we were going to do predictions, aren't we?
Yes.
I definitely want to get to the point where we do predictions for what we think it's going to do for opening weekend. I have to go in a completely different direction, and I want to acknowledge the fact that Daniel Craig is my favorite Bond, and I think Casino Royale is... I think that was the type of Bond movie that we needed at that time. It needed to strip everything away and need to reset Bond back to square one. However, if you ask me to pick a movie that best represents a James Bond movie, I think you have to go with one that has all the cliches, right? Like, I want to see the mustache twirling villain. I want to hear the bad puns. And so for me, I'm going with Goldfinger. Goldfinger is a quintessential James Bond film.
We talk about if aliens landed, what would you show them?
Yes.
We would have to, like, if aliens landed and they said, what is James Bond? I wouldn't put Skyfall in front of them. I would put Goldfinger in front of them.
You have to. Yeah. Because Skyfall was great for what it did for Craig's interpretation.
Sure.
But in a sense, I do love an element of Bond where we don't know anything about him, you know, where he is just this blunt instrument, the way that he's described in Casino Royale, or the right tool for the job kind of thing. There's a character in Goldfinger called Pussy Galore. Like, that's the most James Bond name ever, you know? Like, you can only get away with that in a James Bond movie. That's what causes the Austin Powers spoof, basically. It's Connery, who in his third film has finally figured it out. You know, he really does understand how to play him. Not that he was bad in Dr. No or From Russia with Love in any way, shape, or form. He was just making the character fit him, essentially.
Well, that's the theory, that you get to your third movie, that's the one where it really they say your third one's your best one.
Yeah, I think that that's probably fair.
Unless you're Pierce Brosnan.
And one of the things that I was blown away by with this is it was the first time, I think, and I think Roger Moore got a few more of these. But was that it? That's his first adventure, like, in the States, isn't it? Because it was like Fort Knox was the conclusion. And it never struck me that James Bond could be in the United States. He seems like such a British character to me that when I finally got to see him doing an adventure, like, in some place that seemed relatable, you know, and close to us, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. It made him more human to me as a character. So
he starts the film proper in Miami.
Oh, right. Yes, exactly. Dude, exactly.
Wow. James Bond and Miami are like two things that don't feel like they should go together.
Yeah. All right. So let's get to audience picks. Oh, let's do predictions really fast. What do we think that No Time to Die is going to make over the course of its opening weekend? Start with Jake Hamilton.
No Bond movie's ever cracked 100.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There is a... I believe the highest is Skyfall.
88.
Yep. Which is 88, yeah.
Okay.
So I have... I know everyone keeps talking triple digits. Not
That's interesting.
But I have... because No Bond's ever cracked 100, and it is so long...
It's long.
I'm really kind of hedging my bets a little bit, and I'm going to say somewhere between 90 and 95.
Okay. Gabe, you're writing these down?
Totally. I was 100% writing these down the whole time.
Kevin, what do you think?
So I think it's going to go over 100 for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that there is so much anticipation for this film. If Venom 2 can do $90 million, why can't Bond do over 100?
Venom 2 is 90 minutes long.
Jake's right the length.
I get that, but I think there's going to be a lot of theaters running Bond in multiple theaters. It'll be interesting to see.
Kevin's right. Theaters.
Yeah, but you don't think that they were with Venom?
Oh, I'm sure they were, but I believe they'll probably go out more out of their way to
Jake's
make
right
sure screens. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, but
no,
Kevin
I'm not trying to discount how much people. I'm thinking about like I think Bond will have longer legs than Venom, but I think logistically speaking,
Venom's a symbiote,
it's
though.
Just Jesus Christ.
Kevin, what's your dollar amount? What'd you say?
So just based on how it's done overseas, based on this is the final one.
That's right.
Based on the legacy aspect of it, and based on the fact that this movie has major, major spoilers in it, and people are saying go see it now.
Kevin's right.
I'm gonna be a little adventurous here. I'm gonna go 125.
Oh my! All right.
I'm pretty sure it's gonna be too high, but I'm feeling a 125 million opening for this.
Okay. I'm gonna split the difference, and I'm gonna say 110. I think it does higher than 90. I do think it's gonna pull out an audience that has been waiting to go back to the theater and didn't necessarily go back for Venom. But is going to turn out for this one. Kevin, I think you're right. It's the spoiler aspect. I think people know that it's a big deal.
Yeah,
and they don't want to get it ruined. So I'm going 110.
I think you're probably right. I think I'm on the low end. I think Kevin's a little high. I think if we're Goldilocksing this thing, I think Sean's.
Mike Reyes, right, bring us home.
I'd say between 95 and 105. And one aspect that I'm definitely throwing in here is this is the most extensively formatted Bond we're getting. IMAX is no stranger because they've been doing that since Skyfall. However,
3D,
which
it's
it's
in 3D,
which yes. Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson say looks fantastic. And even
what are they going to say? They're not going to say it looks like shit.
Imagine they did. How's a 3D look?
I'm seeing it. I'm going to be seeing it on 3D.
How have I not heard that it's in 3D?
It's the first time that they've
are
done
they
it.
Are they releasing it in 2008?
Well, they're releasing it in more theaters than Venom did in 3D. Because
Mike, did they do post-conversion?
Venom's in 3D?
Yes.
Yeah. Post-conversion.
Yes, because,
3D.
Yes. Yeah, because I even asked...
Where are these 3D movies at? Like, I go to this theater and
Mike is also our 3D expert.
3D has been woefully underserved as of late because it took me a lot to find... I belong to a certain membership program. I will not name names.
Spectre.
I was gonna say, like, what is this, like the Da Vinci Code? Like, you guys like wear hoods and like what 3D glasses?
I belong to a certain theaters rewards program slash subscription service.
Oh, gotcha.
He's protecting our sponsors that don't exist in case we
if they're even a sponsor that we've worked with. but I had to drive 45 minutes to see Free Guy in 3D. I had to go and this same chain closed the closest IMAX to me, which also had 70 millimeter projection and Dolby. Yes, Kevin, we're taking this theater back. It's a 24 screener on a beautiful location with a pond behind it. But anyway,
dude,
3D, IMAX, D-Box, 4DX, like all these formats were announced as being part of the onslaught. And I'm betting that they did it because the novelty, the opening weekend, and it's just, I think 95 to 105 because there's so many different ways to get money out of the tickets, and that's wait for the 3D.
I just bought my ticket to Finch in 3D.
Kev, do you know the ideal format that Cary Fukunaga would like you to go see this movie in?
True 3 Detective?
Ooh.
That's not bad.
Ice Max?
That's probably better than what I have. Mike, do you know it?
Ice Max?
Nope.
Ice Max.
I missed that.
That's pretty good.
That's not what I had.
Format that Fukunaga.
Yes. I was really excited about mine.
Yours is good. I should have gone with that.
I actually don't know.
True 3 Detective. No Time to Die, Max.
Oh, jeez. That's great.
Thank you.
I actually think they should use that in the marketing.
They should.
I'm not even kidding. That's great.
Thank you. All right.
No Time to Die, Max.
Paul Marsh, Todd, Ignacio Borges, and many others went with Casino Royale for their favorite James Bond film. Synonymous Bosch. That's a great name. Synonymous Bosch. Said GoldenEye. Michael Breen says On Her Majesty's Secret Service, agreeing with Mike Reyes. Be Kind, Harry Lichtman, and many others went with Skyfall. Okay, so for next week, your blend game assignment is # Supernatural Movie Blend. Ooh. We're going to be discussing supernatural movies.
Ooh.
And I guess we'll get into the definition of that in next week's show, because that's kind of open. It's open for interpretation. You can go a lot of different directions. You can play along on social media using # Supernatural
Very,
Movie Blend.
Very straightforward.
Or you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. Why? Yeah, I guess you're probably. Before we move on to this week's review, Mike, thank you so much for joining us to discuss No Time to Die. You need a song. Tell all the people where they can read your fantastic James Bond content.
Mike Reyes.
Well, it's funny because I work for a website called Cinema Blend.
I have
talked about on the internet, and I'm apparently the James Bond expert. They gave me that wonderful distinction.
It's much better than being the Snyder Cut expert, I can tell you that.
That's the truth. His social media people are much nicer to him.
Well, it depends on what I say, but you can find me on social media at Mr. Controversy 83. Again, on Cinema Blend, you will find my James Bond content. By the time this show goes out, I should have the deep dives for Spectre and No Time to Die's endings, because I've been going through the Craig era one by one and sort of looking at how things are set up through those films and where the endings kind of connect.
Two 3D, a 2 3D to weigh yes. in on how it plays, the No Time to Die plays in 3D. So,
and then maybe something with IMAX, because I want to head out to that too.
That sounds terrific. Mike, thanks for joining us, brother. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, buddy.
That was awesome having Mike on. It's nice to have a Bond aficionado, and he knows more. He knows so much about the old Bond films. It's fascinating. You're right. He totally should write a book about
The
Daniel Craig movies. Let's get to this week's review. It came to us via realblend@cinemablend.com. It comes from Robert Hillier, and he said, "The last time I reviewed, I complimented and roasted each of you for various opinions. This one, however, is far more personal. Kevin, I have been struggling with OCD for almost 5 years now, and I've just recently been formally diagnosed with it and been able to get on medicine. The last 3 months have been very difficult to get through because of it, as it has flared up severely. Your openness on social media and on the show about this being a struggle for you has been so encouraging for me to hear. Seeing someone who is so good at their job despite struggling with such a difficult condition has been such an encouragement for me that I can be successful both in grad school and in my vocation. Thank you for being so open in such a public platform and letting others know that they are not alone and that we can all get through this together. I'm genuinely thankful for this show and am praying for you during this time. Fast and Furious rules and Hubie, he put, for both of those. So, yeah. Kev, that's, I think it's fantastic. You were mentioning how you were getting some really great response from people in general after you put yourself out there and from the Real Blend family in particular, too. So these types of reviews have been fantastic.
Yeah, and I was actually, and I emailed Robert and thanked him for that, obviously that email. I mean, it meant a lot to me. And that's the thing, I've been saying this a lot recently. It's like, I don't talk about mental health and depression and anxiety for any type of sympathy or anything like that. It's because I feel like it should be talked about more because so many people are going through it. And like the messages I've gotten from people who are going through similar exact things. And like he said in the review, when you see somebody doing something that maybe you want to do, but they also have something that you have, mental health's a real thing. And I'm just happy that we're talking about it more. Because I was in high school or college or whatever, I was embarrassed to tell people like that I was having anxieties about these certain things. Now I feel a little better about talking about them. And also movies are becoming better about destigmatizing mental health.
Look at Ted Lasso.
Right. And it's exactly what I'm saying is like, I'm so happy we're living in a time where this conversation is able to have, because at the end of the day, I have a great life. You know, I have a beautiful wife, beautiful home, great job. I just have a chemical imbalance in my brain.
Terrific friends.
I just have handsome friends. I just have a chemical imbalance in my brain. It's something I was born with. I've had it all my life, and it's just a daily struggle. And I'm not saying it to complain. It's just something that I deal with. So I appreciate the fact that people resonate with it. And shout out to Sean and Jake and Gabe, who have been on the receiving end of a lot of my OCD and a lot of my anxiety and a lot of my depression. And thank you to you guys because you're obviously truly best friends, because I can't believe you guys haven't like don't hate me because I worry so much and like say stuff all the time, so I appreciate y'all putting up with it.
Sean, this feels like a bad time to tell him that he's fired from Real Blend.
All right, I'll send that email tomorrow morning.
Just text me.
Our next premium episode, we're going to be playing the IMDb game, and again, you get access to all of this. We played that one already. We recorded it.
Yeah. Yes.
I'll give you a little tease. I did horribly. I did really bad. You can get more information on the premium episodes at cinemablend.com/realblendpremium. Throughout the course of the week, you can follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week with new interviews, new conversations, and a whole lot more fun. Until then... Ready Player One!
Ooh. Ready Player One as well.
There you go.
Bridge of Spies!